Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, April 10th, 2012. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight, Bora keynote speaker Raj Patel to discuss world food insecurity tonight at the University of Idaho. Idaho inmates challenge execution protocol. Whitman County Commission taking a wait-and-see approach on possible new Hawkins contract, and city committee gives tentative approval to farmers market nonprofit section rules. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Four Idaho inmates on death row have sued the state, saying execution procedures could create severe pain and because the state can allow unqualified workers to carry out the medical procedures that are part of the execution process. The suit names Idaho Department of Correction Director Brent Renke, Department of Correction Operations Division Head Kevin Kempf, and other department officials. The lead plaintiff is Richard Levitt, who was convicted of stabbing Danette Jean Elg to death in Blackfoot in 1984. Joining Levitt in the suit are convicted killers Thomas Creech, James Hairston, and Gene Stewart. The four are being represented by the Federal Public Defender's Office. The 37-page lawsuit also says the state's execution procedures give too much power to prison officials. The policy allows prison officials to use a three-drug mixture or a single drug to kill the prisoner. Under the execution rules, the execution procedure can be changed at any time without notification to death row inmates or their attorneys. Plaintiff attorney Oliver Lowy wrote in the lawsuit, "Executing any plaintiff without notice of the procedures to be used denies each plaintiff the right to a reasonable opportunity to review and to be heard in violation of the right to due process." Yesterday, Whitman County Commissioners met to discuss the impending agreement with Hawkins Company. Whitman County Commissioners are hopeful they will receive a revised contract from the Hawkins Companies as soon as next week. Commissioners met yesterday to talk about possible revisions, provisions, and financial risks in any new contract worked out with the Boise-based company that wants to develop a 700,000-square-foot mega mall on the state line at Moscow. There will also be two public hearings on Monday and Tuesday next week to hear a presentation from Hawkins and take public comments. The hearings will include two Hawkins attorneys as well as an attorney hired by county commissioners to represent the public in a lawsuit filed against the county. The attorney for the commissioners is Mitt Rowland of Spokane, who was hired because county prosecuting attorney Dennis Tracy was considered to be against a contract commissioners signed with Hawkins in early January that would increase the county's share of infrastructure payments for the new mall to $15.1 million. The organization to avoid illegal conduct alleges in their lawsuit against the county commissioners that commissioners violated the Open Public Meetings Act by not allowing for public input before approving the agreement January 3rd. It also says Hawkins is not a registered agent to do business in the state of Washington, making the infrastructure improvements illegal. The current agreement calls for Hawkins to supply two big box stores in exchange for the $15.1 million in infrastructure improvements. Commissioner Michael Largent was the only opposing vote on the agreement. Largent said he will continue to oppose the contract until the liability falls to Hawkins and not the taxpayers. He believes the commissioners should make a revised plan of their own and present it to Hawkins as a starting point for the revision. He also said he has no idea what Hawkins is planning and would like to have some input in matters rather than being dictated to by the company. Largent said, quote, "I'd hate them to come up with some proposed amendment over which we've had no input." Commissioners Greg Parch and Pat O'Neill want to wait to see what Hawkins comes up with. Largent asked Parch and O'Neill what risks the two commissioners are prepared to take for the Hawkins project. He said he has no argument about the need for additional economic development and revenue for the county, but his main concern is that taxpayers will be left to pay for expenses if the project falls through. Latah County Commissioners yesterday extended an emergency disaster declaration issued in late March for the 30 days over depleted county resources. The extension is necessary to qualify for state assistance to repair road damage in Kendrick and Julietta in the Latah County South Highway District and continuing problems along the Potlatch River where the Ed Corkhill Trail is in jeopardy of being washed out by high waters. According to Latah County Disaster Services Coordinator Sandy Rollins, Latah County must show the state of Idaho that local money has run out and that counties do not have the means to pay for more flooding damage. She said, "We do not have the resources or dollars to repair all the damages, and we have a threshold amount that we need to even qualify, and there is no guarantee that we'll even get assistance, but at least we'll have that paper trail." Rollins said clogged culverts, washed out roadway shoulders causing ditch erosion, gravel loss, and mudslides are all due to flooding. Rollins continues to be concerned about the Ed Corkhill Trail, which has already been worked on last month. She expects to receive further requests from Kendrick and Julietta asking for more assistance. Latah County Parks and Recreation Director Andy Grant said the cost for the extended project will be at least $16,000 and maybe even more. Grant said another 600 feet of trail may need more work if the flooding continues. Commissioners are meeting tomorrow to discuss matters further. Officials from the city of Kendrick are hopeful that more funding will be available to cover the costs for trail preservation and repair. Grant said there is also an Ed Corkhill Trail Fund set up for concerned parties to contribute. The Moscow City Council's Administrative Committee looked favorably on a new set of legal parameters for the Friendship Square part of the Saturday Farmers Market proposed by City Attorney Randy Fife. The committee decided yesterday to send Fife's plan to the full City Council for further discussion and possible approval. The Farmers Market is organized by the City Arts Department and is held Saturday mornings from May until October in part of the city-owned Jackson Street parking lot. Fife's plan is to designate what has been called the nonprofit area of the Farmers Market along the wall of New St. Andrews College in Friendship Square, the speakers section. The speakers section would allow nonprofit groups to table under the same terms as for-profit groups. Fife said the groups will be allowed to sell things that are not available for sale in the regular Farmers Market vendors section.
A few things. It deregulates it more than what was proposed earlier. There won't be numbers on the spaces. We won't have 11 spaces or 10 spaces. We'll maximize the number of spaces along the wall that are available, and people can put up whatever they want there. A sign, a card table, a 5-foot table, whatever they want. And they can use it, they can share it, they don't have to tell us who they are, there's no application, there's no hold harmless agreement.
That's City Attorney Randy Fife. Fife said the users of the speaker section of the market will have to keep their setups within 5 feet of the new St. Andrews College wall on the south side of Friendship Square, and the rest of Friendship Square would be for other things, such as the playground activities and live music seating. City Supervisor Gary Riedner pointed out to the committee the city would be operating under a legal framework that uncouples the farmers market from some of the Friendship Square activities that traditionally occur on Saturday mornings in conjunction with the market.
The Jackson Street parking lots are a parking lot, a proprietary function of the city, and essentially leasing that space, if you will, to another city program, the Farmers Market, which has a totally different type of interest than the Farmers Market. So taking it out of that That does not mean the arts department can't reserve it and use it for uses complementary to the market, but it is not part of the market and is not regulated by the market. And that, is, in my mind, is a significant change that will serve the city's interests well.
That was Moscow City Supervisor Gary Riedner. The Administrative Committee also yesterday approved formal rule changes for the farmers market for this year, including a ban on dogs at the market that had already been approved by the City Council in March. British-born American academic writer Raj Patel, who specializes in analyzing the world food system, will address the Bora Symposium tonight at the University of Idaho. The keynote address, which starts at 7 p.m. at the University of Idaho Student Union Building Ballroom, is free to the public. The Bora Symposium is held over several days every year to discuss the causes of war and how to end it. During a briefing with local reporters this afternoon at the University of Idaho, Patel spoke about the connection between food distribution and war.
A lot of the inventions that we know today as sort of natural parts of our food system were invented through war. So, for example, canning was invented by the French military. The modern controlled experiment and the science of nutrition was invented by the British in order to stop their sailors from developing scurvy. So you have a there are a range of things that war and food have produced. But the really interesting moment for me is looking at how food changed during the Cold War. Because while the Soviet Union and China were having red revolutions, and while Iran was having a white revolution, there was a green revolution happening in the fields. And the green revolution is something that's really worth looking at if we're concerned about how to feed the world in the future. Because people who've witnessed the green revolution say that because of this Cold War intervention, funded in large part by the United States government and also by US foundations, most of the third world was able to feed itself. And if that's true, then that's a model that we definitely need to be looking at in the future. But if it isn't, and I argue that it probably isn't, then we need other ways of thinking about the future, and we need to pierce holes in this sort of rhetoric of how the Cold War was won through food. So that's the story that I'll be talking about, is really the war that I'm interested in is the Cold War. And the reason it matters is because a lot of the templates, a lot of the ideas that we're being told are going to feed the future are based on a misreading of the history of the Cold War and a history of how food featured in the Cold War.
Are you talking about like the industrialization of the food system?
That's basically? Right. But it's not just the industrialization. I mean, when you had the Green Revolution, it was about improved, you know, the sort of standard story of a plant breeder, Norman Borlaug, goes down to Mexico and through his hard work invents miracle wheat that is spread around the world, and everyone plants it and everyone eats, and by 1970 he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. And certainly he won the Nobel Peace Prize. I mean, no one's going to argue with that. No one's going to argue with the fact that he in Mexico invented this amazing wheat that was a cross between Japanese and local varieties and, you know, spread them around the world. But what's interesting is that it's not necessarily the case that everyone planted it, and the yield increases certainly happened in the areas where some of the stuff was grown. But the crops that were chosen for the Green Revolution, I mean, if you go to Mexico, bread isn't a big thing there, right? Corn is the main crop, but actually corn wasn't the thing that was done for the Green Revolution. In India, where wheat is a big thing, the crop they focused on was corn, weirdly. So the Green Revolution was not just about these sort of improved seeds, but it was also about government funding, about helping big farms to get bigger, but also by having subsidies and by having grain marketing boards and by having grain storage, actually, which I approve of. I think that's a very good idea. But these were all part of the Green Revolution. But today in the food world and in the policy world, when you hear this rhetoric of the Green Revolution, really all you hear is what we need are improved seeds. What we need is, you know, Monsanto's latest or, you know, Syngenta's finest stacked gene. And not, you know, you rarely hear the stuff about government intervention. You rarely hear the stuff about everything that you need in order for seeds to be able to do well. And you really don't hear about distribution. And I think that's the That's the key issue here. If you look at the trajectory of people going hungry during the Cold War, it's true that fewer people went hungry by the end of the Green Revolution than started. But that's only because China did so much to feed its people. If you take China out of the equation, in fact, the number of hungry people rose by 10%. So even this rhetoric of feeding the world through having more food, which undoubtedly there was more food available, but people still went hungry. And that paradox of more food and yet increasing numbers of people going hungry is something we have to deal with right now, right? Because, you know, we were in a world where there are more or less a billion people who are going hungry, and we're producing more food than we ever have before per person in human history.
So you think another Green Revolution is probably unlikely to feed the world. Is that part of that because of the population pressures?
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. I think right now what we have is not a population issue. As I say, mm-hmm. per person, we're growing more, we have more calories per person before than ever before. So how can it be a population issue if, mm-hmm. if we're taking all the food and we're dividing it per person and we still have more than we had, you know, 40, 50 years ago? What we have right now is a distribution problem. Now, that's not to say that in the future we're not going to have to worry about that. And I'll be talking a little bit about some of the ideas we can use to address that. But right now, I think it's an important myth to bust. That, you know, we're told that you know, we must gird our loins and produce more and squeeze ever more out of the earth, when in fact the problem isn't so much that as figuring out how to make sure that everyone eats.
So are you saying that there's enough food out there, but due to the political and, you know, international conflicts that are still out there, or what? I don't know what the causes are that mm-hmm. we can't put the foods in the mouths of the people that need it.
Well, you're right that there are problems between the production of food and its consumption. But you only have to look to the United States to see what some of those problems are. I mean, no one would say that we have international conflict within our borders, and yet we have, 48 million people who are food insecure in this country. And that's a problem, right? I mean, that has nothing to do with war, but it has everything to do with how the needs of the poor are being trumped by a system that would rather sideline them. And I think that kind of conflict is class conflict. You can say it's class war, and it is. And I think that's when you see increasing levels of inequality and you see increasing levels of poverty and increasing levels, I mean, numbers of people who are food insecure in this country, class war is a very 20th century way of describing it, but it's not inaccurate.
Could you define for the readers and the audiences out there food insecure? What do you mean by that?
Oh, that's very good. So food insecurity is basically the idea at some point during the year you're not able to know where your next meal is coming from. And the USDA has a sort of questionnaire, and the questions on it are, have you or your family skipped a meal today? Were you worried at any point this week that folk in your family would not have enough to eat because you didn't have enough money? Have you chosen not to eat today because of something else? Or, you know, do you go to bed hungry? You know, these are some of the questions. And if you answer yes to three or more on a 20 or so questionnaire, then you are deemed food insecure for that year.
There's 48 million.
48.2. And that's down from what it was. It peaked at 50 million, more or less. But it's been that way really since the recession hit. And I think that's the answer to your question. It's not... The reason people go hungry today is not from a shortage of food. It's because of poverty. And whether it's here or elsewhere in the world, there's plenty of food around in a region, even in a famine-affected region. The work of the great Nobel laureate Amartya Sen, he pointed out that in every major famine since the Second World War, more or less, there's always been food in the region. But the reason that people go hungry is not from a shortage of food, but because if you have food and you have quite a lot of it, your economic incentive is to hoard that food, because you know that if someone's willing to pay $10 for a bag today, they'll pay $20 tomorrow. And so through these, you know, very rational economic pressures, other people starve because they're not able to afford $20 for a bag tomorrow. So that's why you have hunger, because food gets rationed in a famine. But more broadly, the reason we have hunger today is because we ration food through the market, and many people in the United States today are too poor to be able to, you know, to meet the demands of rent and, say, healthcare, usually healthcare, and being able to feed a family.
So tonight, you're going to be speaking, at the risk of oversimplifying at least part of this, mm-hmm. you're going to be speaking to an audience full of college students who don't miss many meals. How do you get through, what is it you want to say to them to paint this picture?
I mean, I think that the contradiction of living in a world where there are 1 billion people who are hungry and 1.5 billion who are overweight. So we have more overweight people than we've ever had in human history. And our country has both of those. We are the most obese country on earth, and we have 48 million people who are food insecure. And I'll bet that many of the students in the audience, while they may not miss meals themselves, know people who do. Because, I mean, what are the odds? I mean, we're in a country where 1 in 6 is food insecure, and many more than that are affected by hunger. If you look at the figures, 1/4 of all American school kids are on some forms of food assistance, and 1 in 2 of our young people at some point in their academic careers as a child will be on some sort of public assistance. It's not terribly far removed from everyone's lives here, and I think reminding them of that, and then suggesting that in many ways we're still better off than other parts of the world, but then taking them through some of the dynamics that are very similar, the dynamics of poverty amid all the food that is clearly in the fields around you, that those kinds of dynamics I suspect are going to be familiar to more than one person in the audience tonight.
So what can a citizen do to solve the distribution problem?
Well, I mean, I think that if we think of ourselves as individuals, we're constrained a little bit. We're encouraged, you can donate to a food bank, you can shop smarter, you can write to your congressperson. I think that these are smart things to do. But I do think that we've, if you look at the history of fighting hunger in this country or any other, the answer has come through organizing. And so, the school lunch program in this country was brought about by church groups and by women's organizations. The school breakfast program was really pushed by the Black Panthers, oddly, in Oakland. I mean, the federal government had the program, but they never funded it until the Black Panthers in California fed more people than the state of California did. So, I think the answer is actually quite empowering. If you think, look, I'm just one person, what can I do about this distribution problem? The answer is, a little, but you're going to feel overwhelmed. But you feel so much more powerful when you're in an organization. And I think the answer here is to organize. And the good news, again, is that more and more groups, whether faith-based, whether groups like Occupy or whatever it is, there are a lot of groups around the country at the moment that are organizing to address this distribution problem. And I think that's really quite hopeful.
That's Raj Patel speaking this afternoon at the University of Idaho during a press briefing. Raj Patel, who is a British-born American academic writer who specializes in analyzing the world food system, will address the Bora Symposium tonight in less than an hour at 7 p.m. at the University of Idaho Student Union Building Ballroom. The event is free and open to the public. Raj Patel will speak about the causes of war and conditions for peace, food's role. Patel has received degrees from the University of Oxford, the London School of Economics, and Cornell University, and has worked for the World Bank and the WTO and protested against them around the world. He has testified about the causes of the global food crisis to the U.S. House Financial Services Committee and is an advisor to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. His most famous book is Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, and his newest book is The Value of Nothing, which is on the New York Times bestseller list. The symposium will continue tomorrow with two events. One will be a panel discussion at 11:30 a.m., called Local Food in a Globalized Society. That will be held in the sub-silver and gold room of the Student Union Building at 6th and Deacon Street in Moscow. It'll be a moderated panel discussion by small-scale Palouse farmers on the importance of sustainable local food production in a globalized society. Tomorrow's keynote speaker will be Dr. Vandana Shiva. She will speak about water wars and the future of food. Shiva left academics to found the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, a participatory public interest research organization, and later when she found that global corporations wanted to patent seeds, crops, or life forms, she started the Navdanya International Institute to protect biodiversity, defend farmers' rights, and promote organic farming. I asked Raj Patel this afternoon during the press briefing to go into a little bit more about the topic Vandana Shiva will be speaking about, which is GMO foods.
I want to get your perspective on one of the things Vandana Shiva is probably going to talk about, yeah. And that's GM food. If someone, assuming someone out there is trying to control the world's food supply, the Monsantos of the world, how essential is the proliferation of GM crops for that?
I mean, I think that there are a lot of different ways in which the food system is controlled, and a lot of different actors. I certainly think that Monsanto is an important actor there, because by controlling the seed supply and by controlling the genetic diversity of what gets planted, you're absolutely at a pinch point in the food system. But that's not the only place that the food system is controlled. I mean, the world's largest food retailer, for example, Walmart, is also in the business of driving down and constraining what it is that farmers get to grow and what they get paid and what consumers get to eat. I mean, you know, it sounds perverse when you go into a Walmart and you see one of everything, right? And you think, well, I'm in an emporium of choice. How could it be, you know, how can I be constrained in this environment? But it turns out that actually what you see in Walmart is very, very tightly curated. You're not going to see the kinds of variety and diversity that you see at a local farmer's market. At least one study in Vermont has suggested that if you want, you know, variety of organic produce, for example, you're better off going to a farmer's market where that stuff's cheaper than going to a supermarket. But the new masters of the universe when it comes to food are also hedge funds and the financial industry. And it's hard, they're hard to see. Mm-hmm. But when you saw the price of food go up in 2008, as we all did, we saw the price of goods in our supermarket trolleys going higher and higher. The finance industry was deeply involved in that, and that involvement has only become ever more concentrated over the years, as our finance industry has become more concentrated now than it was in 2008.
So I was curious about how you kind of found this niche writing about the connections between, I guess, the global food crisis and, you know, in this case, conflict and you know, peace and things like that. I mean, it's been a nice career for you, right? You've written a couple of best-selling books. What was the spark that got you interested in food?
I've been involved in looking at globalization and social movements. See you later.
Thank you very much.
For a long time. I mean, I've been involved in protests and organizing for social justice since I can remember. I mean, you know, I was 5 years old when I was collecting money for the famine in Ethiopia. So, you know, it's not. But that wasn't because it was a food issue, it was because it was a justice issue. And so I've been involved in stuff around economic globalization for decades. But food has become, the first book I wrote was about food. And that was, it seemed a good way of pulling together a lot of the things that I was interested in. And also I was lucky enough to meet in the late 1990s, an international peasant movement called La Via Campesina. And, you know, the National Family Farm Coalition here in the United States are members of this movement of now 200 million farmers. Mm. And I've been inspired by them, and I really derive a lot of knowledge and inspiration from their example. So seeing them, and really what they were doing is protesting against the existing order of things, but they have a vision for the future that I've been really excited by. And that vision of, you know, of democracy in the food system, that they call it food sovereignty. But really what it's about is communities and cities and regions and states and governments having a genuinely democratic process around food. And that's the kind of thing that I think we can all believe in. And so what's been nice about doing, about certainly writing about food in my first book, was talking a lot more about exploring some of those issues and being able to bring together the consumer side of, you know, needing a better food system with the struggles that are happening in the fields, whether right here or whether, you know, in Malawi.
So do you feel like, like you said, you know, bring a democratic process to the food system. Do you feel like we're almost in a food dictatorship in this country?
Where that's a lovely way of putting it.
You don't really have much choice.
No, I mean, it's a good term. I mean, I think that You know, for example, there was a petition to the U.S. It was the FDA, I guess, around the labeling of genetically modified crops. I'm getting my USDA and my FDA mixed up because I'm still a little punch drunk from the flight. Let me check that and get back to you. But there were a million people who signed a petition saying we would like the labeling of genetically modified crops in our food. It's not even a kind of ban. It's just we'd like to know that they're there. And this particular government agency registered those million signatures as one comment. I think in many ways the USDA is a creature of the farm industry, and there are many small family farms who do not find their interests represented by the Department of Agriculture. I mean, the Department of Agriculture historically is really about the agricultural industry and large farms. Since they represent a fraction of the population of the United States, I do think that we're beholden to their interests far more than a democracy should suggests it should be.
I wanted to ask about a new issue that I've been hearing about land purchases in developing countries by Western multinational corporations.
Yeah.
Tell me what you're aware of there.
So this is a sort of more recent phenomenon, though. I mean, it's important to put it into context. I mean, these things that they're called land grabs. I think land grab is a loaded term, but it's an accurate one of companies from and investment funds and sometimes sort of governments from other countries coming in and buying up land, mainly in Africa. So they're going for land where contracts are murky, where there isn't a sort of free market. And an area the size of France was bought up in 2010, mainly in Africa. And we don't, I'm not sure what more recent figures are, but that gives you an indication that there's quite a lot of this stuff happening. But bear in mind, of course, you hear a lot in the European press, for instance, about, China is buying up land in Africa. And, this idea of, you won't believe what they're doing. They did what we did. Colonialism was precisely the idea of people marching in and just getting stuff. They didn't even pay for it. But it's true also that what's happening when these interests of these companies, these investment funds, the countries are going in, what they're doing, they're not just buying up land. I mean, they're not buying up the Sahara, right? They're buying up land with great access to something else. Now, sometimes that's water, sometimes that's shipping, sometimes that's mineral, sometimes it's oil, it's gas, whatever it is. But they are buying up land, and what we know for sure is while the World Bank, for instance, who's very keen on this idea of investment and other people coming in by, say, look, surely this could work out because you're buying the land, you're taking it from someone who's not able to provide all the inputs and maximize the efficiency of this land, and you're giving it to someone who does. So the person who's selling this land does well because they get money, and the person who's buying this land does well because they invest in it and they get a return. How fantastic is that? Now, willing buyer, willing seller, it's the perfect kind of free market exchange. And the trouble is that, as I mentioned, the kinds of places where this happened, there's no free market, right? This is often a backroom deal. Often the people who are on the land are not the people who own the land. The majority of land in Africa is owned by governments, not by individuals. So it's governments selling away something on which their citizens are to someone else for pennies on the dollar in terms of the real market value, fair market value of that land. And the people who are dependent on that land are often sort of just kicked off. And what's interesting is, wherever you look, the common denominator is that women are most hurt by this. We have examples of where women who depend on the water, for example, on the land, to be able to harvest that water and be able to carry it somewhere and sell it, or even just use it in their homes. When they are denied access to that water, their livelihoods are cut off, and certainly their lives are made much harder for having to walk far, far further to be able to get access to water. But in a recent report that the World Bank did, What was really striking was that the World Bank was very keen to be able to sell this as, you know, the next big thing for investing in Africa. And even they couldn't somersault through the facts, that they couldn't make this seem, make this appear to be anything less than as heinous as it was.
That was American academic writer Raj Patel, who specializes in analyzing the world food system, and he will be speaking at the University of Idaho's Bora Symposium tonight at 7 p.m. It's a keynote address. It's at the University of Idaho Student Union Building Ballroom and free to the public. He spoke to reporters this afternoon. The Bora Symposium is held over several days every year and discusses the causes of war and how to end war. Raj Patel received degrees from the University of Oxford, the London School of Economics, and Cornell University. He worked for the World Bank and the WTO, and then he protested against them around the world, including during the WTO protests in Seattle in 1999. He's testified about the causes of the global food crisis to the U.S. House Financial Services Committee and is an advisor to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. His most famous book is Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System, and his latest book is The Value of Nothing, which was a New York Times bestseller. The Bora Symposium continues tomorrow morning at 11:30 a.m. There will be a discussion on local food and globalized society in the Student Union Building Silver and Gold Room. It'll be a moderated panel discussion by small-scale Palouse farmers on the importance of sustainable local food production in a globalized society. And then the third day of the Bora Symposium concludes tomorrow with Dr. Vandana Shiva, who's a physicist and internationally renowned activist. Her keynote speech will be Water Wars and the Future of Food. It will be 7 p.m. tomorrow at the University of Idaho Student Union Building Ballroom. It will be free and open to the public. The Student Union Building is at 6th and Deakin Street in Moscow. Shiva left academics to found the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, which is a participatory public interest research organization. And then when she found that global corporations wanted to patent seeds, crops, or life forms, she started Navdanya International to protect biodiversity and defend farmers' rights and promote organic farming. She will speak tomorrow night at 7. Raj Patel, who you just heard from, will be speaking tonight at the Student Union Building Ballroom at 7 p.m. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly cloudy tonight, low 44, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms afternoon tomorrow, mostly cloudy, high 57. North wind 5 to 15, gusts up to 20, and a 90% chance of showers tomorrow night, low 40, west winds 15, gusts up to 25 miles per hour. On Thursday, 60% chance of showers, mostly cloudy, high 54, southwest winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 20, and a 20% chance of showers Thursday night before midnight, and again another 20% chance of showers Friday afternoon. Otherwise, mostly cloudy, low 34, high 54. Partly cloudy Friday night, mostly sunny Saturday, and again on Sunday with highs around 55. Currently, fair skies, 65 degrees in Moscow. Thanks for tuning into the KRFP Evening Report. Remember, you can help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix and the recordings of local events and public affairs shows by becoming a member of Radio Free Moscow. You can join Radio Free Moscow by sending your membership dues to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students. You can mail your memberships once again to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or check out the Radio Free Moscow website for more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. That's also where all our evening report newscasts are archived for you to listen to at your convenience. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a good night. Change Surfer Radio, which is not producing new shows at this time, will have a program on maybe next week, and it'll either be new if they start producing new shows, or we'll go to the archives in the 6 to 6:30 p.m. slot. Coming up next, a special from Red Eye Radio in Vancouver, the health effects of climate change on Canada's north. It's about a 10-minute interview. That'll be followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio at 6:30. Music begins at 7:30 with Gary Lange here on KRFP Moscow. Have a good night.